If what they say is true, Paul Bunyan was born down in Maine. Must have been a pretty husky baby, too, just like you'd expect him to be from knowing him afterwards. All right. This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And I hate to be interrupting my story for such as this.
When he was only 3 weeks old, he rolled around so much in his sleep that he knocked down 4 square miles of standing timber. And this is Pam Vesper telling you that this program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And the government got after his folks and told them that they'd have to move him away. And this is Bob Martin with another version of Did You Know?
So then they got some timbers together and made a floating cradle for Paul and anchored it off of Eastport. But every time Paul rocked his cradle, if he rocked shoreward, it made such a swell it came near drowning out all the villages on the coast of Maine. The waves were so high, Nova Scotia pretty near becoming an island instead of a peninsula.
Well, that wouldn't do, of course, and the government got after them again and told them they'd have to do something about it. So they figured they better take him home again and keep him in the house for a spell.
But it happened that Paul was asleep in the cradle when they went to get him. They had to send for the British naval, and it took 7 hours of bombarding to wake him up.
And when Paul stepped out of his cradle, it made such a swell it caused a 75-foot tide in the Bay of Fundy. Several villages were swept away, and 7 of the invincible English warships were sunk to the bottom of the sea.
Well, Paul got out of his cradle then, and that saved Nova Scotia from becoming an island.
Now, I ought to say that the King of England sent over and confiscated the timbers from Paul's cradle and built 7 new warships to replace the ones he'd lost.
When Paul was only 7 months old, he sawed the legs from under his dad's bed one night. The old man noticed when he woke up in the morning that his bed seemed considerable lower than it used to be. So he got up and investigated. Sure enough, there were the legs all sawed off from under it and the pieces laying out on the floor.
Then he remembered he felt something the night before, but thought he must be dreaming, the way you dream that you're falling down sometimes.
Well, he looked around to see who could have done it, and there was Paul, laying there, sound asleep, with his dad's cross-cut saw still tight in his fist, and smiling in his sleep as pretty as anything.
He called his wife and asked her, "Did you feel anything last night?"
"No," she said. "Is anything wrong?"
"Well, just look you here." He showed her the 4x8s laying there on the floor and the saw in their kid's hand.
"I bet that boy of ours is going to do some great logging, bigger than any of the men around here ever done."
And he was right.
Now that was storytelling at its finest. Not lying, but sheer, matter-of-fact, proper storytelling.
The kind of stories that come from a people who are still new about being a nation and are proud of it.
It's a country that's big and brash and patriotic in a good way. And it's people demonstrating it in a good way by being just who they are.
And their heroes are still just like they are, only a tad bigger.
Just a tad.
Enter Paul Bunyan.
So, as a part of this episode of Did You Know, we're going to include some Paul Bunyan.
Some folks claim he was born in North Carolina.
No, they don't, Bob.
Well, they might have.
All right. Wherever he was born, Paul is part of Americana. So sit back and enjoy some American storytelling at its best. And we'll get back to Paul in just a bit.
Okay,
I'll start. Though Paul wasn't born in North Carolina, though he might have been, did you know some of my folks were? My great-grandfather used to write me about how hard the ground was.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold it. Your great-grandfather wrote you?
Sure. The post office was just getting started, and it took a long time for the letter to get there. Anyway, the ground was hard.
How hard
was it? No.
Well, now, it was so hard that one day he went out with his post hole digger to plant the mailbox. He needed a mailbox to get my return letter. Well, he turned and he turned and he turned on that digger, and by the time he got deep enough for the mailbox, the front yard was in the back, and the South 40 was up front.
Well, that's nothing. Did you know that my folks came from Oklahoma, where they used to get some winds? Well, my grandmother used to hang a 100-pound sack of flour up outside the front door. One night, a wind came up and blew so hard.
Well, how hard was it?
It was so hard that the next morning we found that wind had blown the sack away and left the flower hanging there.
Hardly a thing. Did you know I had folks up in Washington State who raised apples? Most folks grew apples. My folks raised them. Every summer, my sister and I went and spent vacation, and they let us squeeze our own cider and sell along the roadside. Well, those apples were so big.
How big were they?
They were so big that one evening, when we were closing up, a fellow from New York came by and wanted to buy some cider. Since we were closing, we told him we'd squeeze some more if his order was big enough. He said he wanted 5 gallons. I told him I couldn't waste one apple on 5 gallons.
Wow. So, how did Paul meet Babe the Blue Ox?
Well, folks aren't exactly sure how Babe and Paul got together. Some say Paul got him from Canada when he was just a calf, carried him across Lake Champlain in a sack so he wouldn't have to pay duty on him.
Some say he wasn't always blue. He was white when he was born, and during the first winter of the blue snow, he stood out in a field for 6 days, turned blue, and never turned back.
But some say one winter it was so cold that all the geese flew backward, and all the fish moved south, and even the snow turned blue. Late at night it got so frigid that all spoken words froze before they could be heard. People had to wait until sun up to find out what folks were talking about the night before. Paul Bunyan went out walking in the woods one day during that winter of the blue snow. He was knee-deep in the snow when he heard a funny sound between a bleat and a snort. Looking down, he saw a teeny-tiny baby blue ox just a-hopping about in the snow and snorting with rage on account of he was too short to see over the drifts. Paul Bunyan laughed when he saw the spunky little critter and took the little blue mite home with him. He warmed the ox up by the fire, and the little fellow fluffed up and dried out. But he remained as blue as the snow that had stained him in the first place. So Paul named him Babe the Blue Ox. Well, any creature raised in Paul Bunyan's camp tended to grow to massive proportions, and Babe was no exception. Folks that stared at him for 5 minutes could see him growing right before their eyes. He grew so big that 42 axe handles plus a plug of tobacco could fit between his eyes. And it took a murder of crows a whole day to fly from one horn to the other. The laundry man used his horns to hang up all the camp laundry, which would dry lickety-split because of all the wind blowing around at that height. Whenever he got an itch, Babe the Blue Ox had to find a cliff to rub against, because whenever he tried to rub up against a tree, it fell over and begged for mercy. To whet his appetite, Babe would chew up 30 bales of hay, wire and all. It took 6 men with picaroons to get all the wire out of Babe's teeth after his morning snack. Right after that, he'd eat a ton of grain for lunch, and then come pestering around the cook, Sourdough Sam, begging for another snack. Babe the Blue Ox was a great help around Paul Bunyan's logging camp. He could pull anything that had 2 ends, so Paul often used him to straighten out the pesky, twisted logging roads. By the time Babe had pulled the twists and kinks out of all the roads leading to the lumber camp, there was 20 miles of extra road left flopping around with nowhere to go. So Paul rolled them up and used them to lay a new road into new timberland. Paul also used Babe the Blue Ox to pull the heavy tank wagon which was used to coat the newly straightened lumber roads with ice in the winter, until one day the tank sprang a leak that trickled south and became the Mississippi River. After that, Babe stuck to hauling logs. Only he hated working in the summertime, so Paul had to paint the logging roads white after the spring thaw so that Babe would keep working through the summer. One summer, as Babe the Blue Ox was hauling a load of logs down the whitewashed road and dreaming of the days when the winter would feel cold again and the logs would slide easier on the ice, he glanced over the top of the mountain and caught a glimpse of a pretty yeller calf grazing in a field. Well, he twisted out of his harness lickety-split and stepped over the mountain to introduce himself. It was love at first sight, and Paul had to abandon his load and buy Bessie the yeller cow from the farmer before Babe would do any more hauling. Bessie the yeller cow grew to the massive yet dainty proportions that were suitable for the mate of Babe the blue ox. She had long yellow eyelashes that tickled the lumberjacks standing on the other end of the camp each time she blinked. She produced all the dairy products for the lumber camp. Each day Sourdough Sam made enough butter from her cream to grease the giant pancake griddle, and sometimes there was enough left over to butter the toast. The only bone of contention between Bessie and Babe was the weather. Babe loved the ice and snow, and Bessie loved warm summer days. One winter, Bessie grew so thin and pale that Paul Bunyan asked his clerk, Johnny Inkslinger, to make her a pair of green goggles so she would think it was summer. After that, Bessie grew happy and fat again and produced so much butter that Paul Bunyan used the leftovers to grease the whitewashed lumber roads in summer. With the roads so slick all year round, hauling logs became much easier for Babe the Blue Ox, and so Babe eventually came to like summer almost as much as Bessie.
He was always big, and nobody knew how much he weighed because there weren't any scales that big. And when old Ole made Babe a new logging chain, it took 4 carloads of iron to make the chain. And Babe's body was so long that Paul had to use a pair of field glasses to see what Babe's back feet were doing.
Oh, and mercy, that ox could eat. It took 2 men just to pull the baling wire out of his teeth at mealtime. 4 tons of grain was nothing for him to put away.
And all the towing he did. There was only one time that almost did him in. We were working out of St. Croix, Wisconsin, and there was 18 miles of the crookedest road you've ever seen.
How crooked?
Don't even ask. You wouldn't believe me. In 18 miles, that road doubled back on itself 16 times and made 4 figure 8s, 9 threes, 4 S's, and 1 each of pretty near every other letter of the alphabet.
The trouble was, there was just too much road, so it didn't know what to do with itself and kept on getting into mischief. You'd be walking along, minding your own business, when all of a sudden there was a big hunk of the road wound up behind a tree, just waiting to jump out at you.
Well, Paul knew something had to be done. So, he hitched Babe up to one end of the road, and Babe bore down. You've never seen an ox pull like that. His rear legs were practically straight out, and his stomach almost touched the ground.
But that road was no match for Babe. No, sir. When Babe was finished, there was enough road left over to put it all the way around a lake that we skidded into that winter, with enough left over to reach from one end to the other. Now, that's a fact.
Ooh, need to catch my breath a little now.
While we're catching our breath, we haven't looked at any word origins lately.
Well, now would be a good time. Here's one. The hair of the dog that bit you.
I know. It means if you have a hangover, a little of whatever you were drinking the night before would take the edge off. But where did it come from?
Way back, even in the Iliad by Homer, there is expressed the belief that a wound caused by Achilles' spear could be healed with an ointment that contained some rust from that same spear. More recently, some truly believe that a dog bite can be healed by applying some hair from that dog that bit you to the wound.
How about a bone to pick? Originally, it meant to study something deeply, to mull over a situation. Different cultures phrased it, a bird to pluck, a knot to pick, a pebble to throw. One source even cites a Sicilian practice where at a wedding, the father of the bride gave a bone to the new groom that he had to pick clean of meat, signifying the difficult job of marriage.
Chew the fat or the rag. This possibly alludes to women's sewing circles, where the cloth or rags were worked by the hands, and the mouths shared the gossip or fat.
Charlie horse, generally conceded to be of baseball origin. One story is that a ball player, who was also a serious pony player, had a hot tip on a horse whose name happened to be Charlie. Coming down the stretch, the horse pulled up lame and finished last. The next day, the player took a lot of ribbing about his horse, and then, rounding third and speeding towards home, he pulled up limping and was easily tagged out, at which point teammates hollered, "Just like your old Charlie horse!"
To lead by the nose. For a long time, it was known that you could more easily control certain animals by placing a ring in their nose and attaching a rope to it. Among humans, from the Bible, supposedly when the Babylonians conquered Judah, they marched some of the population off in slavery. They did it by lining them up, running a string down one shoulder with a fish hook, and then stuck the fish hooks into their noses.
Ham actor, from the word hamfather, an actor of low grade. It may also signify actors of low rank who were so poor that they used ham fat instead of more expensive creams to remove their makeup.
White elephant. The king of Siam was known on occasion to give a rare white elephant as a gift. If you gave it away, it was an insult. Trying to pay for its upkeep could bankrupt you. So there you were, stuck with something you didn't want but couldn't get rid of.
Stogies. Drivers of the old Conestoga wagon, originally made in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, used to like to smoke the long, cheap cigars that were made in that region. Over time, Conestoga became shortened to Stogie.
Assassin. This comes from the Arabic word hashhash, which meant one who eats or chews hashish. During the Crusades, an arcane Muslim group carried out secret murders against the Christian invaders while under the influence of hashish.
Deadline. It originated in Civil War prisons, where they didn't have walls or bars, so a line was drawn on the ground. And if a prisoner stepped over that line, he was shot.
Curfew. It comes from the French word couvre-feu, which literally meant cover the fire. The curfew was originally the time when you had to extinguish fires, candles, and lamps.
Okay, I'm rested. How about some more? Paul Bunyan.
When Paul first started, he was determined to build the biggest logging camp there ever was. He selected a spot up in the north woods around Michigan and Minnesota. He knew for a camp this big, he'd need a large water supply. So he dug Great Lakes, and Babe hauled water down to the camp in a huge tank.
One day, the tank sprung a leak, and water came pouring out so fast that it came near to washing the entire United States out to sea. Paul was a quick thinker, so he grabbed a shovel and started digging a ditch to take away the water, and it worked.
Later, they called the ditch the Grand Canyon, and the dirt he shoveled out became the Rocky Mountains. And when Paul finally stopped logging, the ditch kind of dried up a mite.
It was also going to take a big mess hall to feed all those hungry loggers. Paul built a house 3 to 4 square miles. He also built counters around the edge of the building so the loggers could have a snack on their way to the tables.
Now, since loggers' favorite food was pancakes, Paul drained out a small lake for the cook to mix the pancake dough and added a steamboat with a big paddle wheel to keep the batter stirred up.
To grease the skillet, Paul had a couple dozen cooks skate across it with slabs of bacon strapped to their feet. And when the pancakes were done, he loaded them on a train and drove straight to the tables.
Then he added a trough straight from New England to bring the maple syrup.
I know you've got more stories about Paul Bunyan, but if you know it, I'd like to hear about the best man that ever drove a rail spike across America, John Henry.
I would be proud to tell you about John Henry. Now, John Henry was born down south where the Mississippi flows. But from earliest childhood, he knew that he was destined for something other than cotton fields. While still sitting on his daddy's knee, he'd say, "I'm going to be a steel-driving man, and I'll die with a hammer in my hand."
Now, his mother tried all different ways to keep John Henry from the railroads, but they didn't work, and eventually he got his chance. First time he picked up a hammer, he whopped that spike right on down, just like he'd been doing it forever. The boss was amazed and asked where he'd learned that. John Henry said he didn't have to learn it. He was a natural man.
Well, the boss hired him on the spot and told him, "Now, line up those tracks and let me see you whop that steel on down." And that's just what John Henry did.
When John Henry's mother heard about it, she cried and said, "I tried to keep you from this, but I know I can't. The hammer is going to be the death of you, John Henry."
John Henry laughed and asked, "Who said that?" John Henry's mother said, "You did when you were a baby. You said that you'd die with a hammer in your hand." He He told her not to worry, but she did.
Then one day came when a stranger with a strange contraption showed up at the railroad camp. He claimed it was a steam drill, and it could do the work of three men. The boss told the stranger that it wasn't needed because he had something that could do better than that. He had John Henry.
The stranger then wagered that his steam drill could beat John Henry in a race. The boss looked at John Henry, and John Henry said, "It don't make sense, boss. A man ain't nothing but a man. But before I let some steam drill beat me down, I'll die with a hammer in my hand."
Came the day of the race. John Henry stood on one side of the tracks with the steam drill on the other. And when the mayor hollered, "Go," John Henry started whopping and the steam drill started a hissing. All morning long they went down that line. The sun rose high in the sky. The sun went low in the sky. John Henry and the steam drill side by side. John Henry's hammer got a little slower, but it never stopped.
Finally, the sun set behind the mountain. The mayor looked at his watch and hollered for them to stop. Race over. They counted the holes John Henry had made. They counted the holes the steam drill had made. They measured how deep they were and that everything about them was perfect. Then the mayor said in a loud voice, "John Henry drilled more holes and he drilled them deeper. I declare John Henry the winner."
Oh, the crowd cheered, but John Henry didn't. He sat down on the tracks, placed his hand on his heart, laid down his hammer, and died. On his tombstone, there just reads this: "John Henry, here lies a natural man."
Now that is a great story.
Now, so is this one. And mine's true. There was this Yankee farmer who advertised that he had a horse to sell. All of the neighbors knew about the horse and didn't want anything to do with him. As luck would have it, the stranger came by who was looking for a horse. He thought it was a fine-looking horse and wanted to know how much the farmer was asking. Farmer said, $150. "What's wrong with it?" asked the stranger. "A good horse like that should run at least twice that much." "Well, nothing," said the farmer. "I just don't need him any more, and we'll let him go cheap." Stranger looked him over one more time, a little more closely, then said, "I think he's blind." No, he ain't blind," assured the farmer. "Then open up that gate and let him out." The farmer opened the gate, and the horse promptly ran out the corral and smack into a tree, knocking himself out. "Well, if he ain't blind, why did he run into the tree?" "Because," said the farmer, "he just don't give a damn."
Oh, I can top that. And this one is also true. Now, I decided to go into the fireproof money safe business once. So I developed a surefire sales pitch that works every time. I gather people around and tell them, "Folks, I'm selling this guaranteed fireproof money safe, and I'd like to tell you what experience we've had with it. We took this and put a rooster in it, closed the safe, and put it into a 10-story building, which we then proceeded to set on fire. The building burned for 12 hours, and the safe got red hot. We waited for it to finally cool down and opened the safe, and what do you think we found? The rooster was standing there, froze to death."
Well, if it's true stories you're after, where I come from around Frostbite Falls, Minnesota, we had the coldest winter I've ever seen. When I got up in the morning, I had to beat the air just so I could breathe it. My sister and me went into a cave to keep warm and built a fire. It was so cold that this here fire, 20 feet high, froze in a straight column. My sister pulled out a bottle of water and asked me if I wanted a drink. It was so cold her words froze and you couldn't hear a thing. Next 4th of July, we happened by that cave and it was just starting to thaw. My sister was standing there right next to me, and yet I could hear her from inside the cave asking me if I wanted a drink. Now that is a fact.
I don't think we can stand any more of these true stories. So let's get back to Paul Bunyan. Soon after Paul finished digging the St. Lawrence River, he received a letter from the King of Sweden. He had heard about Paul through Ole. Anyway, the king wanted Paul to cut down all the trees in North Dakota so the Swedes could settle there and plant the farmland. And he wanted it done in 1 month so the Swedes could plant at once. And he wanted all the trees cut up into toothpicks for the Swedish army.
Well, since he had to finish the job in a month, Paul hired the 7 axemen. These were famous loggers who could cut down trees faster than anyone except Paul. They were cousins and all named Frank, which made things a little difficult because every time Paul yelled, "Frank," they all dropped their axes to come see what Paul wanted.
Well, now, the seven axemen used big, double-bladed axes that a normal man couldn't even lift. And when the axes got dull, they'd push a big rock down the hill, and then they ran along next to it with their axes against the rock until they were sharp. But no matter how hard they worked, the job was always getting delayed.
Yeah, first Babe lost his iron shoes in a swamp, and a new mine had to be opened just to get enough iron to get him new ones. Then the big fog came. It was so thick that the fish couldn't tell where the water ended and the fog began. So they ended up swimming around in the tops of the trees. The axemen had to chop a hole in the fog from the kitchen to the bunkhouse so the food could be served. The fog even got in the coffee and made it so weak the men couldn't drink it. Plus, at night, they had to sleep under mosquito netting to keep the tadpoles out of their ears.
Finally, they got all the trees cut down, but the King of Sweden wasn't pleased because all the stumps in the ground prevented the farmers from planting their crops. Paul knew that Babe didn't like to get his feet wet, so he flooded the spade, and Babe walked across North Dakota, carefully stepping from stump to stump so as not to get his feet in the water. Every time he stepped, he pushed a stump down 6 feet.
Well, the King of Sweden was satisfied, and to this day, there isn't a single tree in the state of North Dakota.
Did you know that there once was a man from Kentucky that could imitate the crowing of a rooster so remarkably that on two occasions the sun rose 2 hours early by mistake?
Mm-hmm. Did you know that there once was a fellow from North Carolina that could tell a story so funny that he could make a tree laugh? Once he told a story, but the tree didn't laugh for 2 days. He thought he was losing his touch until he discovered it was an English oak.
Ah.
Did you know there was once these two fellows from Tennessee that couldn't tell their horses apart? The traveling man from North Carolina told them that where he came from, men measured their horses by counting how many hands high the horse was. The Tennessee lads tried it, and sure enough, that black horse was 2 hands higher than the white one.
Before we get back to Paul Bunyan, do you know any stories about John Chapman?
I don't remember any stories about John Chapman.
Did you know that he was given the name of Johnny Appleseed?
Oh.
It seems that Johnny Appleseed was born in Massachusetts, where his parents had an apple orchard. Johnny came to love every bit about that orchard, and he gladly worked in it every day. The names of the apples even made a little song in his head. Pound Royal, Golden Pippin, Maiden Bush, Northern Spy, for Apple Sass and Cider, Fritters and Apple Pie, June Red, Roxbury Russet, Fall Wine, Pumpkin Sweet, for apple butter and jelly, and to hold in hand and eat.
Now, he might have stayed his whole life at home had it not been for one thing, a road that led right by his house and off into the distance. One day, a family of pioneers on their way west stopped and asked for a drink of water. Cheerfully, Johnny gave them the water and a handful of apples, and wanted to know where they were headed and why. The old man pointed to one of the apples and told Johnny that the world was round like the apple, and they were on their way west to start a new life. Johnny had never thought of leaving home before, but he started thinking. And then and there he decided he was going west, too. He went inside, said goodbye to his parents, picked up a few things, and climbed aboard the wagon headed west.
Well, when they arrived in Pittsburgh, Johnny asked if they were in the west yet. They told him yes, but there was a lot more to the west, and they were going farther. The old man told Johnny about the rivers and the mountains and the trees. Johnny wanted to know if they were apple trees, and the old man said no, they weren't. So Johnny decided to stay in Pittsburgh for a while.
He found a nice place on a hill and started a farm, raising apples. And pretty soon he had a nice little place with chickens and eggs and cows and beehives and apple trees. Still, he wasn't settled because he kept seeing people move past his house on their way west. He started giving families little trees to take with them, but then started to worry that they didn't know how to take care of them properly, so finally he sold his farm, loaded apple seeds in 2 canoes, tied the canoes together, and paddled off down the Ohio River. And wherever he went, he planted apple trees, and when he went out of seeds, he went back to Pittsburgh to get more.
A lot of people thought he was crazy, but he didn't care. He carried no gun or knife, just a shovel for planting, a pot for cooking cornmeal mush, and a Bible to read. When his clothes got ragged, he wore a coffee sack with holes cut out for his arms and head. When he lost his cap, he wore his mush pot for a hat. When his shoes wore out, he went barefoot. He wanted to do no harm to any critter.
One time he came across a wolf who was caught in a hunter's trap. He released the wolf and tended its injured leg. He might have forgotten all about it if he hadn't been captured by a group of Shawnee Indians. They didn't know what to make of him. They'd never seen anybody in a coffee sack and a mush pot, and the old chief, who was ill, wanted to scalp him right then and there. While they were thinking about what to do, a snapping and snarling came up behind them. It was that same wolf that Johnny had released.
No need to run, Johnny called out to the Indians as he went over and started petting the wolf. The wolf licked Johnny's hand. The Indians had never seen anything like this before and thought he was some kind of medicine man. Well, in a way he was. He had learned all the kinds of plants that could be used in healing, and in a few days the old chief was well again. He became a friend to the Indians, and they even made him a member of their tribe. He stayed with them a while, and then he had to get back to his main job, so he started off again, with the wolf trotting along at his side.
For 40 years he walked the wilderness, moving around the big round apple of the earth, planting apple trees. The seeds he planted grew into great trees with huge spreading branches and loaded with apples, there for the enjoying. Then one day out in Indiana, he laid himself down under a tree that he had planted years ago. He was an old man now. His beard was white and his bones were tired. He watched the blossoms drifting and he felt the soft breeze on his cheeks. And as he closed his eyes, a song ran through his head. Pound Royal, Golden Pippin, Maiden Blush, Northern Spy, for apple sass and cider, fritters and apple pie. June Red, Roxbury Russet, Fall Wine, Pumpkin Sweet, for apple butter and jelly, and to hold in the hand and eat. Johnny Appleseed had planted his last tree.
You have anything to add, Bob?
Here's the story of the Whistling River, so named because twice a day it reared up to a height of 200 feet and let loose a whistle that could be heard for over 600 miles, and it was the most honored river in all of the U.S. of A. It took a fiendish delight in plaguing the life out of loggers who worked it. It would tie their logs into knots, flip men into the air, then toss them back into the banks, and break apart whole rafts of logs as soon as the loggers put them together. This fact by itself might not have been enough to get Paul Bunyan involved. But one day Paul was sitting on the hill by the river, combing his beard with a large pine tree, when without warning the river reared up and spat 419 gallons of muddy water onto his beard. This startled Paul somewhat, but he figured if he ignored the river, it would just go away and leave him alone. But that ornery river just reared up again and spat 5,019 gallons of muddy water onto his beard, adding a batch of mud turtles, several large fish, and a muskrat into the mix. Paul Bunyan was so mad, he jumped out, and he let out a yell that caused a landslide all the way out in Pike's Peak. "By jingo, I'm going to tame that river or bust a gut trying," he cried. So Paul sat for 4 days eating popcorn and trying to figure out how to tame that river. He ate so much popcorn that the air was soon filled with white bits, and the ground for 3 miles around was covered with 18 inches of popcorn scraps. This caused several hundred small animals and a few dozen birds to conclude that they were in a blizzard, and so they froze to death. This furnished the loggers at the camp with pot pies for several days. Just as he ran out of popcorn, Paul decided that the way to tame the river was to pull out the kinks. He would hitch the river to Babe the Blue Ox and let him yank it straight. Of course, Paul knew that an ordinary log chain and the skid hook wouldn't work with water, so he and Babe took a short walk up to the North Pole. There, Paul made a box trap, baited it with icicles that he set near the blizzard trail. Then he and Babe wandered away. Paul started to throw icebergs out into the ocean so Babe could play fetch. But he had to stop the game, since each time Babe jumped into the water, a tidal wave threatened to swamp the coast of Florida. After lunch, Paul went back to check the trap. He had caught 6 young blizzards and an old northwester. He put 2 of the young blizzards in a sack and released the rest. Then he and Babe went back to their camp. As he walked into camp, Paul yelled to Ole, the big Swede, to build him the largest log chain that's ever been built. Then he staked out the two blizzards, one on each side of the river. Right away, the river began to freeze. By morning, the river had a tough time rearing up to whistle because it was frozen solid for more than 17 miles. When Paul Bunyan finished his breakfast, he harnessed Babe and wrapped the chain 72 times around the foot of the frozen Whistle River. Yelling to the men to stand clear, he shouted to Babe to pull. Babe pulled the chain into a solid bar and sank knee-deep into solid rock. But that ornery river refused to budge. So Paul grabbed the chain, and he and Babe gave such a yank that the river jerked loose from its banks, and they dragged it across the prairie so fast it smoked. After a while, Paul looked back and saw the river was as straight as a gun barrel. But the river was much shorter with the kinks out, and all the extra length that used to be in the kinks were running wild out on the prairie. So Paul got his big cross-cut saw and a lot of baling wire and sawed the extra lengths of the river into 9-mile pieces, rolled them up, tied them off with baling wire. He later used them to float his logs when he logged out in the desert. Now that it was straight, the Whistling River lost its gimp and refused to whistle, which made everyone mad at Paul Bunyan because now they didn't know when it was time to wake up in the morning. Paul might have been in real trouble if Squeaky Swanson hadn't showed up right about then. Squeaky's speaking voice was no louder than a whisper, but when he yelled, you could hear him clean out in Kansas. So each morning, Squeaky got up at the crack of dawn and yelled the blankets off of every bed in camp. Naturally, the men found it hard to sleep in the cold without their blankets, so they got up. Squeaky was a great success, and for the rest of his life, he did nothing but get up at dawn and let out one really loud yell. How about another one, Kurt?
Well, now, Paul Bunyan scouted round the north woods of Wisconsin for quite a while before he found the perfect spot for his winter lumber camp. It was right next to a fast river, and Paul figured they could pile up the logs right next to it, and come springtime, it would be mighty easy to tumble the logs into the river and float them down to the mill. Soon the woods beside that mighty river were bustling with activity, and calls of "Timber!" as the lumberjacks felled the huge trees. Babe the Blue Ox was kept busy from dawn to dusk hauling logs to the river, and Sourdough Sam, the cook, hardly stepped foot outside his cooking shanty neither, working all day and most of the night to keep all them lumberjacks fed. Took about 20 cooking assistants alone just to make enough flapjacks for Paul Bunyan. Well, by the time spring rolled around, they had logs piled up so high folks passing through Wisconsin mistook them for a mountain range and thought they'd reached the Rockies. The mighty river was free of ice, and Paul declared himself ready to take the first batch of logs downriver to the sawmill the very next morning. In preparation for his journey to civilization, Paul struggled out of his huge red long johns and took a bath in Lake Superior. Then he washed the long johns and strung them up to dry on the flagpole. When they flapped in the breeze, it scared the migrating birds so much they turned around and went back south. Paul Bunyan, the shanty cook Joe Murphy, and other river drivers all piled onto the log raft and set off downriver. It was a pleasant ride overall, and we were singing as we went.
Now, we'd been on the water about a week when we came around a bend in the river, and there was another logging camp that looked like our old one. We told Paul that someone had been borrowing his ideas. We wondered who was copying us, but we didn't stop to investigate. But about a week later, we came around a curve, and there was another camp built like Paul had built. There was the same cookhouse with the logs out back and the bent stovepipe from the time Babe tossed Ole over the roof for putting castor oil in his feed bin. Oh, don't even want to think about that.
Anyway, we talked about how alike the camps were for the next whole week. We had almost talked it out when dang if we didn't come upon another camp identical. And this time Paul gets mad enough so he jumps off the logs to go up and see what this was all about. He tramps through every building and turns over every log he finds, but he's stumped. No answer at all. He searches and thinks on it for about a week and is just about to give up when what does he see? but his own logs with his own men on them coming around the bend of the river.
And immediately it comes to him. They're on a round river. That where we'd been a-logging on the round river. Well, Paul has got to think of something quick because he had to get these logs out of that circle and down the river to the sawmill. So he decides if we can get the river to jump over the banks, it straightens itself out.
So he puts the cooks to work making up a big batch of sourdough. Old Ole thinks they was cooking up something to eat. Paul just ignores him. When it's ready, Paul has the cooks pour the batch into the river. What a sight it was. There was the men with big shovels stirring the sourdough into the river, Paul throwing more bags of flour in on top, and Babe stomping the mixture to make it fit tight in the river. There was so much flour in the air it looked like snow, muddy snow, but snow just the same. I bet the air will look like that for years to come, probably even all the way down to that Fort Detroit.
Well, Paul's idea worked. The water bubbled and hissed and all of a sudden let go with a mighty burp. With the help of all that yeast in the sourdough, and over the banks that river went, straight down the hill on the way to the sawmill, and that was that.
Did you know that when I was a young'un back on the farm, one of the biggest problems we had was the crows getting into the cornfield? They were a major source of discomfort on the farm, and we tried everything to keep them away. We used air cannons and wind machines and scarecrows, some that moved up and down, some that moved sideways, some that made the awfulest noise you could imagine. The crows would sit back and look at this stuff for about a day, and then have them all figured out, and back they came. Once we even had this thing that buzzed around the tops of the corn. All that would happen was that when it ran out of gas, it would take a dive right down into the corn and take out half a row before it stopped. And on top of that, the crows started walking into the cornfield instead of flying, and they'd pick the bottom couple of ears from each stalk and then walk back out. I tell you, the crows have got to be the smartest and orneriest bird ever to have made it off the ark. Anyway, one day, this fella comes by with a newfangled kind of scarecrow. And my dad wasn't interested. Guaranteed it would work. Daddy still wasn't interested, knowing it would be just another waste of money. Fella says he'll put the scarecrow in for nothing, and if it don't work, Daddy can have it, free of charge. Well, Daddy can't say no to that, so in goes the scarecrow. Now, this is where the story gets weird. The scarecrow doesn't do anything. It doesn't hop or jump or make any noise at all. It just sits and twitches a little bit every now and then. And just plain looked weird. The kind of weird like when that one kid back in school would reach up and turn his eyelids inside out. You looked at it, and you just wanted to go, brrr. Well, let me tell you, it worked. There wasn't one crow that would set foot in the cornfield. They took one look at that scarecrow and didn't say, caw. They said, whack. In fact, it worked so well that not only did the crows not steal any corn, but two of them went home and brought back corn they'd taken two nights ago. And Daddy bought a bunch of them scarecrows and even put one up in me and my brother's bedroom.
Speaking of the Ark, did you know I have a page from the log of the Ark, which is an official Sumerian naval document?
But I don't know Sumerian.
Don't worry. I have a translation of it in Greek. Anyway, after the worst of the flood was over, and Noah's wife was happiest of all when it happened because she had only brought two brooms with her, Noah sent out ravens to look for dry land. Well, the raven didn't find anything, so Noah waits a week and sends out a dove. Again, no dry land. But she did bring back a couple of sardines, and Noah had to think about that for a while. Finally, after another week, the dove goes out again and finds an olive branch. She heads back for the ship, figuring Noah is going to be happy, and especially Mrs. Noah is going to be relieved, because she had begun to talk in some funny languages about something called the SPCA. Well, she searched and searched, but couldn't find the ship. It's gone. All she could see was the sea. The bird began to tire when all of a sudden she spotted a lone piece of wood floating along the surface of the water. At least she could rest. She neared the piece of wood. She saw two termites sitting on the board, looking as if any minute they were going to topple over. The dove landed next to them and eyed them carefully and then quietly asked if they had seen an ark. One, rolling his eyes, let out a burp and said, I can't believe we ate the whole thing. And that really happened.
Back a spell, you said that only put half the logs in the river. Well, what happened to the other half?
Oh, I didn't forget them, and neither did Paul. As soon as the first batch was safely in the mill, of course it took all of Lake Michigan to hold them, he started back for the other logs. When he got there, he found they had another big problem. Those other logs were stuck behind the sourdough still back on the Round River. And on top of that, a great big cloud of steam kept rising off the sourdough from all the fermenting going on. That steam had formed a fog so dense that it filled the sky there, and then found its way clear across the Atlantic Ocean to London, where they're still using it today.
So Paul's sitting there, thinking, while combing the water out of his beard with a pine tree. Suddenly he jumps up and says, "Boys, we're going to straighten this river out once and for all." He grabs a big tow chain in one hand, and he grabs that Round River in the other, pulls up and wraps that chain 47 times around the river. The river doesn't take too kindly with this and starts bubbling water all over Paul. But Paul doesn't care. He just sets his teeth, walks over to Babe, and wraps the other end of the chain around the big blue ox. Babe bears down so hard that his feet sink down through 6 feet of solid rock, but that river isn't budging. So Paul steps in next to Babe, then grabs a hold of the chain, and they both pull.
Together, nothing could stop them. That river let out a howl and a yell and a roar that sounded like thunder, and suddenly everything was smooth and quiet. No more twists, turns, kinks, or circles, just straight river for as far as you could see. And that big plug of sourdough, well, it broke loose and floated all the way to San Francisco, where I hear they put it to good use.
Now, once that river was straightened out, Paul had a lot of it left over, and not wanting to waste things, he sold pieces of it off. Some he wrapped in baling wire and sold to a farmer in dry country. Some he shipped out west to help some folks in a place called Las Vegas. And the piece that carried the sourdough all the way to San Francisco, he sold to some steamboat folks down around St. Louis.
Did you know, I used to run Henry Winehards out of Saragossa. Longhorns they were. Maybe they were shorthorns.
Don't ask. Please don't ask.
All right. Here's my last story about Paul Bunyan. Remember I told you Paul never liked to waste things, so he used to save everything. One thing he used to save was hotcakes. The cooks couldn't cook just enough. You sure had better not leave a lumberjack hungry. The mess hall was so big that once in a while a lumberjack would faint from hunger, getting from the mess house door to his table. That's why Paul put in those side tables I told you about earlier. Well, 200 to 300 hotcakes left over after every meal began to stack up. How else are you going to store them? And something had to be done.
Well, Ole came up with the bright idea of feeding them to Babe. Now, hotcakes were not a part of Babe's regular diet, and at first he didn't take to them. But then one day, as I remembered, it was right after Ole had slipped him the castor oil, he took to them. And from then on, look out. It got so bad the men couldn't finish their breakfast. Babe was eating the hotcakes right off their plates, maple syrup and all.
This didn't set well at all with the men, and they raised a mighty complaint to Paul. Now, Paul scolded Babe, warned him, tried everything, but no luck. Babe just kept eating those hotcakes. Finally, Paul took Babe off a ways and chained him up to a mountain. Babe couldn't break that chain, so Paul thought he had the problem solved. But he didn't.
No. As soon as Paul turned his back, Babe gave a mighty yank on the chain. Maybe he couldn't break the chain, but he could, and did, rip the top off the mountain. Then back he came for more hotcakes. The end came one day when Babe snuck around in back of the chow hall and saw hundreds of hotcakes, right off the griddle, sitting on the edge of the stove, ready for the train to take them to the tables. In jumped Babe and swallowed the whole bunch of them, stove and all, in one gulp.
Well, Babe felt pretty pleased with himself until the heat of that red-hot stove started to kick in. He let out a bellow that could be heard clear to Canada, kicked down the whole chow hall, and tried to find something to quench the heat of that fiery stove in the pit of his stomach. Figuring it would take some mighty cold water to stop that fire, he lit out for the North Pole, with Paul hanging onto the chain, skimming over all of Canada, lakes and mountains and whatever. Then he started gulping down that icy Arctic Ocean.
Well, we haven't seen Paul for quite a while now. Let's suspect he'll be back sometime.
We figure they're still up there with Babe drinking up the cold water and letting off steam from that red-hot stove inside him. Because, well, lately, the winters haven't seemed to be as cold as they used to be.
What else could it be?
I bet somebody will blame that on global warming, too.
Bob, listening to you, I understand why some animals eat their young. Does anyone else have a story?
Did you know I was part of a rescue team down in Louisiana after Katrina hit?
No.
We were out trying to save anybody we could see that was in trouble. Well, we were out in this boat and we came across this house where a man was sitting on top of a box on his front porch with flood water lapping at the bottom of the door. We said, "Jump aboard. We're here to save you." Well, he said, "I don't need you. My faith is in the Lord." Well, the water kept on rising and we came back by his house the next day. Only now the water had covered the entire bottom floor, and he was leaning out of his attic window. We told him, "Get aboard, the water's rising." Again, he refused, saying, "I have no need for you. My faith is in the Lord." The next day we passed by again. Only now we're in a helicopter, and the water is up to his roof, with him standing on top, holding on to the chimney. "Grab the ladder. This is your last chance," we hollered at him. Still, he refused again, pointing to the sky. "My faith is in the Lord." Well, shortly thereafter, he finds himself standing before the Lord, and he says, "Lord, I'm mighty disappointed in you. I trusted in you, and you totally let me down. I was sure that you would save me, and what did you do?" The Lord replied, "I sent two boats and a helicopter."
To close this episode of America, we go to the folklore of the Great Northwest, the cremation of Sam McGee. By Robert Service. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. In the Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee. Now Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home in the south to roam on the pole, God only knows. He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him like a spell. They'd often say in his homely way that he'd sooner live in hell. On a Christmas day we were mushing away o'er the Dawson Trail, and talk of your cold through the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail. If our eyes we'd close and the lashes froze, so sometimes we couldn't see. It wasn't much fun, but the only one to whimper was Sam McGee. And that very night, as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow, and the dogs were fed and the stars o'erhead were dancing heel and toe, he turned to me and, "Cap," says he, "I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request." Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he says with a sort of a moan, "It's the cursed cold. It's got right hold till I'm chilled clear through to the bone. Yet 'tain't being dead, it's my awful dread of the icy grave that pains, so I want you to swear that foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains." Now a pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore I would not fail. And we started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. He crouched on his sleigh, and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee, and before nightfall a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. There wasn't a breath in that land of death, and I hurried, horror-driven, with a corpse half-hid that I couldn't get rid because of a promise given. It was lashed at the sleigh, and it seemed to say, "You may tax your brawn and brains, but you promised true, and it's up to you to cremate those last remains." Now a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load. In the long, long night, by the loom fire light, while the huskies round in the ring, howl out their woes to the homeless snows. Oh God, how I loathed the thing. And every day that quiet clay seemed to heavy and heavier grow. And on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grub was getting low. The trail was bad, and I felt half mad, but I swore I would not give in. And I'd often seen to the hateful thing, and it hearkened with a grin. till I came to the marge of Lake LaBarge, and a derelict there lay. It was jammed in the ice, but I saw in a trice it was called the Alice May. And I looked at it, and I thought a bit, and I looked at my frozen chum. Then here, says I, with a sudden cry, is my crematorium. Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared such a blaze you seldom see, and I burrowed a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared such a blaze you seldom see, and I burrowed a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so, and the heavens scowled, and the hiskies howled, and the winds began to blow. It was icy cold, but the hot sweat rolled on my cheeks, and I don't know why, and the greasy smoke in an inky cloak went streaking down the sky. I did not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear, but the stars came out and they danced about ere again I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, I'll just take a peep inside. I guess he's cooked, and this time I looked. Then the door I opened wide. And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm in the heat of the foreigner's roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, please close the door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you let in the cold and the storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. And did you know that I was sitting in a pub once, enjoying a pint of bitters when a fly flew into my drink? Being the good Scotsman I am, I didn't ask for another or simply flick it off the foam. I grabbed him up by the wings and shook him and said, all right, you little booger, spit it all back.
This is Pam Vesper. Did you know that I was sitting there next to Kurt sipping my great Pinot Noir when that termite from Noah's Ark walked in and said, where's the bartender? The termite said, where is the bartender?
And this is Bob Martin. And did you know that I once walked into a bar?
Well, what happened?
I said, ouch.
What?
It hurt.
Good night.